93. The same kid I sold my Acura to when he was the youngest drug dealer in the hood, running around with Killer Black getting into shootouts. I scooped him up from Brooklyn and took him to Soundtrack Studio. He said he was rapping now and went by the name Littles. I was happy that he wanted to change his life around, so I cut him a check and had him put a song on the movie soundtrack. I even let him lay an 8-bar acapella on HNIC so he can get his buzz started. Little Lord seemed like a different person now, no longer acting like the cocky, ruthless badass. He was acting real humble and happy to be free. Right after Little Lord came home, Hazman Freeha from QB was also released from prison for murdering a cab driver on 21st Street in Queensbridge. At Soundtrack Studios, Freeha, who came home with 2 razor slashes across both sides of his face from a fight in Rikers Island, explained that he beat the murder rap because his lawyer proved that Freeha couldn't have killed the man since he was the one that called 911 from the payphone up the block. Not only did he beat the murder, but Freeha also sued the New York Department of Corrections and won $40,000 for getting cut in jail. Freeha had turned into a blood in jail and also turned into a rapper. Chris Lighty threw a big Violator Records party in South Beach, Miami. Mobb Deep was on the bill to perform with Busta Rhymes. So Havoc and I brought our whole crew. We stayed at the Shelbourne Hotel. I stopped by my mother's apartment to surprise her. She had gotten tired of New York and moved to Miami around 96. I took Alchemist and Gotti along so moms could meet Al. We talked for about an hour, then hopped back on our scooters and rode around South Beach. Later that afternoon, Alchemist and I jumped into a mini golf cart looking vehicle and drove to Soundcheck at Club Amnesia, with palm trees grew from the dance floor up into the open ceiling sky. Alchemist and I were waiting to check out the sound system when we overheard a conversation between 2 guys. "Yeah, I hear Mobb Deep is gonna perform tonight," one of them said. "Those guys think they're so tough and gangster. I don't like them at all." I brushed it off as cheap talk, but during sound check, I noticed that the guy who was talking was the sound man for the show. The spot was jam-packed later that night, as we stood by the bar watching Rod Digger open up for Busta with some girls behind her in tacky patent leather outfits that said Flipmo Squad all over. Busta is always an extremely hard act to follow. After 2 songs, our mic started to sound terrible with loud feedback while the music was extra low. "Yo, you better fix this shit," I screamed at the sound man. "You fucking up our show." But it only got worse. "Wow, this dude really purposely fucked up our show because he don't like us," I thought, remembering what I overheard him saying earlier. The sound for Busta's set had been perfect. After the 4th song, we had to end our show because it sounded awful. I found Chris Lighty and I told him, "I know this is your party, so out of respect, I'm coming to you to tell you that I'm about to beat the sound man up." "Okay, cool," Chris said. "Are you sure?" I asked. "I'm not playing." "Come on, I'll help you find him," Chris said. Chris brought me right to the sound man. "Excuse me, my man," I said. "Can I ask you a question? Do you have something personal against me and my team? Did we do something to you?" "No, I don't have a problem with you guys," he said. "I don't know what happened. The sound was just acting up." I pretended like I was turning to walk away while cocking back my arm so I could knock him out. I swung with my right fist, hit him dead in the mouth with my platinum ring, knocked out his 2 top teeth, then quickly walked to the bathroom to wash the blood off my hand and swap shirts with our security guard, Tim. I gave Tim my royal blue throwback Braves jersey with white short sleeves, and he gave me his mustard brown striped polo shirt. The cops had all the club exits blocked off. Luckily, I switched shirts, because when we walked out, the cops tackled Tim to the ground with guns at his head. While they struggled with Tim on the ground, Chris Lighty's older brother, Dave Lighty, walked with me in the opposite direction and paid some fool $100 to give me his scooter so I could zip out quick. Tim got arrested and we bailed him out the next day. He had to go to trial for that and lost his gun license. I gave Tim some bread for doing that for me. And then, like a month or two later, the sound man sued me for $20,000 for his dental bill, and won. Working on music at our Long Island house one day, Hav told me he wanted to throw a gangster party at the crib that weekend. "What's a gangster party?" I asked. "A sex party, an orgy," Hav said. "We invite like 10 females that know what the party is all about, then we invite just a few close friends and get it popping, a gangster party." Oh, okay, I said. "Let's do it." Have it call some strippers and some girls we knew who would dance for whatever. We invited Nas, L.E.S., and Little Lord. Gotti, Noid, Papa Marv, Twin, and Ty Nitty lived at the house, so they were automatically invited. Havoc also invited a female rapper named Chi-Town, who was bisexual, so there'd be lots of females for her to have fun with. The night of the party, I picked Little Lord up from Brooklyn, and we pulled up to the Freeport crib. Havoc had disco lights flashing throughout the whole place. Nas and L.E.S. pulled up at the same time as us. Females were walking all over the house in bikinis or nothing on at all. I poured a cup of Moet, and Hav told Nas and me to follow him up to his room where four chicks were waiting for us. They pulled out condoms and started giving us all top at the same time. The tall, thick, dark-skinned cutie who was giving me head suddenly stopped, pulled me behind her, and got on her hands and knees. So I started hitting her tall ass from the back while she began giving head to the girl who was sucking Nas's dick. We had him in all kinds of freaky positions and had room for about 40 minutes. Then I bounced downstairs and left Hav and Nas in the room with the girls. I was finished. I poured another cup of Moet and enjoyed the scenery. Havoc and Nas came downstairs as Chi-Town walked in. Hav grabbed her by the arm and made her sit on the couch. Then Hav had two other females take her pants off. "Stop, what y'all doing?" Chi-Town yelled, acting shy because Nas was standing there watching. The two females pulled her panties off and started eating her out. "Stop, come on," Chi-Town resisted. "What are y'all doing?" But suddenly she was speechless, pushing the girls' faces deeper into her. I left early and took my ass back home to Kiki. When she asked me where I'd been, I told her we were working on music. But she ain't stupid. Women's intuition is powerful. It seemed like Kiki always knew when I was being bad. Shit, what was I supposed to say? I was at Hav's gangster party? Ron Artest had become a big-time NBA star for the Chicago Bulls. And when he heard about what I was doing with Bars and Hooks in the Queensbridge movie, he gave me $90,000 in startup money to help with the expenses. Studio time, records, stickers, travel expenses, Infamous Records chains for DeLorean and Bars, and Infamous Records levers, jerseys, t-shirts, and bandanas to promote the label. Ron Ron, as we called him, was a real-ass nigga for looking out like that. To this day, if he asked me for anything, I would do it for him. The new millennium came, and the entire world was on pins and needles, thinking the end was here. News channels were spreading fear. Supermarket shelves were empty from people stocking up on food and water. On New Year's Eve, 1999, instead of going to the Tunnel, Justin's, or Cheetah's, as usual, Kiki and I played it safe and popped champagne while watching the ball drop on TV at home. It was finally 2000, and contrary to what everybody thought, nothing happened. In rural Rockland County, when the ball dropped, all we heard was gunfire from machine guns and pistols. I thought a war had started. I forgot that we were up in the mountains with redneck Dukes of Hazzard white people who hunt deers and bears. Kiki and I made our own porno movie and went to sleep. I bumped into my boy from Left Rack, Shameek's homeboy, E Moneybags, on my way to Chung King's studio by the Holland Tunnel in Manhattan. Bags and I always randomly crossed paths. He loved Mobb Deep. "You the god, Pete. You're killing these niggas with Quiet Storm," he said. Bags was a well-known ghetto celeb. The female rapper Foxy Brown even shouted him out on the Firm song, Affirmative Action. Bags and I started hanging out every day after that, talking for hours about the Illuminati, secret societies, the corrupt government, and history of the Moors. Our appetite for hidden knowledge was the main thing we had in common. Bags invited me along to visit his homie, 50 Cent, a new rapper with a hot single called How to Rob, who was recovering from multiple gunshot wounds. He said 50 was asking about me. I told Bags that I didn't really know 50 like that and wasn't going to make it. After Killer Black's wake in Queensbridge and identifying my father's body in Atlanta, I told myself I wouldn't go to any more wakes or funerals. The crew was mad at me for missing our boy Yammy's wake in Brooklyn, but I didn't want to see any more of my people in a casket. So even though 50 was alive, I didn't want to see him hurt up like that. Keep It Thorough was one of the last songs I recorded for HNIC. The beat Alchemist made had a horn break that sounded like a natural hook, so I wrote the song without a chorus. Chris Lighty and others kept telling me, "You can't just leave it like that. It needs a chorus with vocals to get radio play." But one of the lines on the song says, "Heavy airplay all day with no chorus. I keep it thorough, nigga." To have no chorus was the whole concept of the song. People liked my music because I didn't follow the rules. I did and said whatever I wanted. Kiki kept bugging me to let her rap on the album when I was 95% finished. Making a good quality album was more important to me than letting my wifey spit on the song. The way I saw it, she was just like everybody else who wanted to make a cameo on my album just because they knew me. I only do songs if it makes sense or sounds good. But then Alchemist made the perfect beat that sounded like a ghetto love story. Kiki and I sat up all night in our house in Pomona writing Trials of Love, about a young couple going through the ups and downs of a music industry relationship. It was her first time in the mic booth, and I had her do the verse 30 times, but she ended up getting it right. Kiki had writing skills, but I didn't want my woman in the same business as me. So I told her it was just for fun, and it wasn't going any further than that. After the Limp Bizkit tour, Mobb Deep did our own club tour across the country. It wasn't nothing compared to those big stadiums, but it was still good money. Bars and Hooks came along to get touring experience, and I noticed Havoc was keeping his distance from them. You could just tell that he didn't want to work with them. That's how Hav was. All he cared about was Mobb Deep and his own music. DeLorean and Bars felt like Havoc was dissing them and took it personally. I realized Bars and Hooks were talented musically, but mentally, they weren't ready to deal with us. During a 3-month break after the tour, I wrapped up HNIC. The final song I recorded for it was You Can Never Feel My Pain by Sickle Cell. I thought it would be interesting to get TLC's T-Bars to sing on the chorus because she also had Sickle Cell. Steve Rifkin set up a meeting in a studio in Atlanta. I carried the 2-inch reels with me on the flight. 2-inch reels are reel-to-reel tapes that we recorded all the music and vocals on before Pro Tools came out. T-Bars showed up an hour late to the studio with her then-husband, rapper Mac 10. T-Bars and I immediately started talking about how we dealt with Sickle Cell. When she heard the track, I wasn't pleased with her response. "It sounds good, but I don't know if my label's gonna let me do it," she said when I stopped the music. "I'll find out and get back to you." Right away, I knew she didn't want to do it. It's a shame. But she was cool as hell. Steve Rifkin told me the same thing T-Bars did. "Her label doesn't like the idea of her being on a song with a gangster rapper," Steve said. So I just made a simple hook and my album was done. Steve Rifkin was serious about promoting my album, and Lal started running magazine ads for HNIC 6 months in advance. Since my album was called Head Nigga in Charge, I was sitting on a throne in the ads. The idea came from the end of the movie Conan the Barbarian, where Conan sat on the throne like he was king of the world. Keep It Thorough took off, and I hit the road again for my H&IC tour. Bars and Hooks came along with DeLorean's uncle, Green Eyes. I was training Green Eyes to be a road manager. His leg was still healing from being shot in the calf muscle by one of Supreme's boys. When Green Eyes came home from doing that 15, the first thing he did was step to Supreme about why he hadn't sent any money to him or his family while he was doing time. Green Eyes explained to me how he had to whip Supreme's ass. Supreme couldn't live with that ass whooping, so he had one of his boys shoot Green Eyes in the leg like 5 minutes after the fight. Wow. Green Eyes got up early every morning to walk around the hotels, building the strength back in his leg. The fans were feeling Bars and Hooks, but DeLorean kept bothering me about why Havoc didn't like them. Havoc don't gotta like you, nigga, I ended up screaming one day, but they still felt offended. Their logic was, Havoc is from our block. We grew up with Havoc, not you, P. Havoc should be showing us more love. Havoc wasn't obligated to do anything for them. They were signed to my company, not Mobb Deep. Those were some hard-headed little bastards. We toured the entire East Coast and Midwest, and while we were in Chicago for a performance at our boy Ron Artest's birthday party, an interview I did in The Source came out. I picked up a copy in the Chicago airport when we landed. The Source put me on the cover, my first magazine cover as a solo artist. In the interview, the writer, Shaheen Reed, asked about my problem with Jay-Z, referencing an online interview in which they asked if I liked Jay-Z. No, he's a bitch boy. He talking and don't live it, I said. I elaborated for The Source. Jay-Z has a quote in his song, Money Cash Hoes, where he claims, New York been soft ever since Snoop came through and crushed the buildings. I'm trying to restore the feelings. But Jay was nowhere to be found when that drama popped off between Mobb Deep, Dog Pound, Tupac, and Biggie. That was our little personal beef, not a coastal war. Jay-Z ain't had shit to say when it was on, and he was getting dissed. Him and Nas. Mobb Deep and Biggie were the only ones from New York active in that situation. So Jay-Z is a bitch-ass nigga for making that quote in his lyrics. Yeah, it was on now. Ron Ron and a few of his boys from Queensbridge came to pop my wet with us at the hotel later that night before the party. I would drink a little champagne or wine occasionally. It's only a problem when you're down in bottles without any discipline. QB was deep in Chi-Town that night. The two-level club was packed. The VIP balcony wrapping around above the dance floor. I bought bottles for my boys with a bunch of fake $100 bills from my Keep It Thorough video that read, for motion picture use only, at the top instead of United States of America. By the time the club figured it out, we finished the bottles and we couldn't be found in the enormous crowd. Calls started coming in from industry folks when I arrived back in New York. Jay-Z is upset because of what you said about him. I was like, and? Am I supposed to give a fuck? Fuck him. I didn't call him a bitch boy to make him happy. I did it to provoke him to start dissing me. And I said it because it's the truth. The whole rap world was talking about me calling Jay-Z a bitch. Radio, magazines, websites, and all. It was only a matter of time before bitch boy came back at me with something. And that was exactly what I wanted. I knew most of the shooters and live wires from Jay-Z's hood and the other two projects near Marcy, Tompkins, and Sumner. So I already knew who Jay-Z would run to. That's my advantage over him. That's how I knew he didn't live what he rapped. But Jay didn't realize I had those connections. My nigga E Moneybags went to high school with Jay, and Bag's sister is married to Sauce Money, who is one of Jay-Z's artists. I had connections through the whole borough of Brooklyn, from Red Hook, Cypress, and Pink Houses to Brownsville, Crown Heights, and Bed-Stuy. When I openly expressed my opinion to Jay-Z to the world, it opened up the floodgates on him. Suddenly, Several different rappers started openly saying the same things about him, from Fat Joe to the Lox and more. Even LL Cool J started firing shots at Jay. Jay has a line in one of his songs that goes, "First the fat boys break up, now every day I wake up, somebody got a problem with Hov." The song is called "Ain't No Love" or some bitch boy shit like that. Let me be clear. Jay-Z makes excellent music. I really liked a lot of his stuff. But this was not about his music, and it had nothing to do with jealousy or envy. This was about the man behind all that, Sean Carter, aka Bozo the Clown. My situation with that dude wasn't a rap battle, it was personal. Touching up edits for the clean version of YBE, Young Black Entrepreneurs, featuring BG from Cash Money, my son Shaka joined me for a session at Soundtrack Studios. Shaka was 5 years old at the time. Mike DeLorean and my man George from Queensbridge also came along. My engineer, Steve Sola, told us that Nas was working in Studio B again that night, so we walked over to say what's up. When we walked in, we saw Nas, Jungle, Grand Wiz, Horse, and his brother Dula, and some dude we didn't know, along with a few females. DeLorean noticed some big buds of weed on the countertop, plus a few bottles of liquor and a camcorder. Right away, DeLorean picked up one of the buds to smell, and Nas got upset. "Yo, why you touching that shit? That ain't yours," Nas asked. "Damn, I'm just looking at the bud," DeLorean said. "I wanted to smell it." Then, DeLorean picked up the camcorder and started to inspect it to see what kind it was. And Nas barked on him again. "Yo, what the fuck is wrong with you, son? I told you stop touching other people's shit. Man, what the fuck is your problem? I'm gonna look at it if I feel like looking at it. What's the big deal?" DeLorean said. Nas was clearly a little drunk from the Grey Goose and cranberry juice in his hand, and still had sour feelings about that old freestyle DeLorean and Cormega put out dissing him. He was also clearly upset that DeLorean was talking to him like that now. Nas walked up to DeLorean and motioned with the cup in his hand like he was going to toss the red drink in DeLorean's face, but paused and tossed it on the shoulder of DeLorean's white t-shirt. There was a moment of silence. Then DeLorean grabbed Nas by the throat with his right hand and pushed him up against the wall, choking him. "Nigga, don't you ever in your life play yourself like that," DeLorean said. "You fucking stupid or something? I'll kill you, bitch-ass nigga." All of Nas' boys jumped up, but Drawers yelled, "Chill, if they gonna fight, let them fight one-on-one. Ain't nobody gonna be jumping nobody here." I screamed at Mike DeLorean to let Nas go, and he did. Then we took DeLorean back to Studio A. My son Shock was watching it all in shock. Back in Studio A, DeLorean said, "P, give me the gun. I'm shooting this bird-ass nigga. Give me the gun." And I replied, "Hell no, nigga. You bugging, man. You already choked him up against the wall and he ain't trying to fight you back. Just leave him alone." After about 10 minutes of calming him down, I went into the hallway and Nas walked up to me apologizing. "I'm sorry, man. I had too much to drink," Nas said. "Please forgive me, man. It's all good. Just forget about it. That nigga's bugged out, though," I said. "Nah, I'm really sorry. I'm telling you. I'm just bent right now, and I overreacted," Nas said. "I shouldn't have done that. That was foul." "Don't sweat it. We good, man," I said. Then we both went back into our studio rooms. February 27, 2009, Mid-State Correctional Facility, Marcy, New York, 10 a.m. On the wreck! The loud, obnoxious, military-style shout from the CO abruptly woke me up from my sleep. He was letting the whole dorm know it was time for recreation. Pulling myself off the steel cot attached to my cell wall, I forced myself to go to the yard. "Come on, boy, let's go," I said to myself. "You owe it to your family and to the people who love your music. Now get your ass out there and work out." It was raining hard, so I grabbed my green hoodie and workout gloves, and ran to catch up with the other inmates. Out of 30 inmates in my dorm, only 4 of us went out to brave the weather. The yard at Mid-State Correctional Facility is the size of a football field and has a large shed with plenty of weightlifting equipment, pull-up bars, dip bars, and concrete picnic tables. I went out every morning. You've been in the game 17 years. What makes you think people are still going to care about you when you get home? I constantly asked myself. My answer was always the same. Because of my ability to create music, my attitude about life, and my physical appearance will all be better than it ever was. With all that in mind, I worked out hard for 3 hours every day. But I worked on my music and attitude more than anything, especially my attitude. My mother always told me, if you don't have anything nice to say, then don't say anything at all. I didn't fully understand that until I was forced to sit in a cell and think about my whole life. Damn, I had a big mouth. I needed to tone it down, a lot. I enjoyed being a fearless badass, doing and saying things others were scared to. As a teenager, I got my kicks out of doing things like standing on a long department store line of white people and their children and reciting the lyrics to N.W.A.'s Niggas for Life. Why do I call myself a nigga, you ask me? Well, it's because motherfuckers won't blast me. Seeing how those lyrics made white people uncomfortable would make my day. My boys laughed hard afterwards, saying, yo, you crazy, P, what's wrong with you? It was fun being bad. We smoked weed and drank big bottles of alcohol in train cars full of passengers, robbed people in front of numerous witnesses, and wreaked havoc throughout the 5 boroughs. There weren't as many cameras, police, or thousands of tourists roaming the streets of Manhattan. If you were a teenager growing up in the 5 boroughs during that time, you know why I acted, talked, rapped, and carried myself the way I did. The concrete jungle education that New York City provided me is priceless. I'm sure it was similar in every inner city on the map. But nothing compares to the every man for himself state of mind that New Yorkers have. You won't find that level of ruthlessness anywhere in the U.S. The 80s and 90s were like gladiator school in the streets. My attitude was in sync with my environment. But change is imminent, and nothing stays the same. When I think back on all the things I've done in the streets, I realize how blessed I am to still be alive. Sometimes I feel like I'm in one of those movie scenes where everything is moving at light speed around the person in the middle who moves ever so slightly, slowly and calm.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.